So you came to British Columbia in
1936,
and your family, you had grown up in the city, but you had relatives who were living on the farm, so mm-hmm. you had a lot of contact with that. Why did you come to Vancouver?
Well, there was, Dad died, for one thing. And I thought, now if I'm ever going to make a move, now's the time to do it. But I was sorry after, because my mother had a stroke. And this is something that's very sad. Mother had a chance to get married again, and my brother and sister were at that stage where they're mischievous without knowing it. They interfered, and it broke, so that Mother didn't get married. What they didn't know, Mother became the babysitter for their children. And to me that was cruel, because you see, there's nothing so lonely as a person when their partner's gone, or somebody's been married many years. It's unbelievable. My husband has been gone now 5 years. It's going on, like, I'm into the sixth year. Mm-hmm. And when you've had a close relationship, it's very sad. So I came to Vancouver, and Mother was home, and it was after my husband, unbeknownst to me, he would, when he went through Regina, he would take time off to stop and go and visit my mother. And on one of the trips, he came back and he says, "Pack up, and I want you to go and see your mother. There's something the matter with her." And when I went home, she'd had a stroke. And so I brought Mother to Vancouver, and that's another story.
Right.
It's heart-rending to deal with people who have had a stroke. Mother was always looking. She was looking for what had been,
mm-hmm.
and I'd take her for walks, and she'd say, "Oh, Mrs. So-and-so lives there." And, you know, I could tell how her mind was working, and it was sad. One morning I woke up about 2 o'clock, and I'm waiting for Mother to go back to the bedroom, and I'm waiting, and so I got up. My God, I near died. The front door was standing wide open. It was pitch black. I went to look out. Heavens, I wouldn't have found anybody in a lifetime there. I phoned up the police. I was crying, would send a man down to help me find my mother. He says, "What kind of a coat has she got?" I said, "A red one." He said, "She's here." A baker going to work had 4 o'clock. By this time it was 4 o'clock. It was going to work. Had seen Mother walking, and she was going to the waterfront. She was going to kill herself. She said, because, what was the point of living? And, I was just horrified. So I had to take Mother back. And even on the train, she got away from me. I stopped at a little store. They let you off. You had 10 or 15 minutes to make a purchase or whatever, and I got off to get something. And my God, I went all aboard. I went to get on the train, and my mother is way down the road. Well, I just about collapsed. Anyways, they went and got her. And I realized it's no use fooling around it. And the doctor advised me to take her back to Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm. Put her in a home there?
Yes, said to me, I said, "Well, I couldn't conceive of it, because the conditions here were superior." He says, Nothing like it, young lady," he says. "The conditions in Saskatchewan are superior to anything here." I wouldn't have believed it. But I did take her back, and I must confess I wasn't too pleased with the treatment of her in the hospital. It was, her arms were black and blue from top to bottom. I never I couldn't get an answer from anybody of what had happened. And, at that stage, they're not themselves, and so, anyways, I had to take Mother back. And it wasn't easy. It's a heart-rending business.
But you had left her there in 1936?
I had to. Well, yes, when I left home. Right. As I said...
How old were you then, around?
19.
19, right.
And I could write books, you know, the struggles here for...
Right.
For your union, and as a delegate to the Labor Council, you became aware of all the things going on.
When did you marry then?
Three years later.
And how did you meet your husband? Through the union movement?
The union.
Okay, so when you came to Vancouver, you first worked as a domestic and then you worked in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And what were the conditions like in the restaurants in those days? You described the
hours
shift work.
Hours and hours of work. Hard work. 25 cents an hour. And first of all, to learn the trade, it's a tough job. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, I'm watching girls today with 5-inch heels. And some of them look like prostitutes, frankly. What they're doing is ruining conditions on the job to even... deemed to go around wearing 5-inch high heels on the job and working on rugs, because in 5 years from now they're going to have varicose veins they won't believe, you know, this stupidity.
Mm.
And they've been breaking down conditions right and left. They're glamorizing on the job. It is tough, hard work. But I loved it, you know, it was...
What kind of things would you... What did you do as a waitress?
You worked shifts, and I never worked in a house that didn't work around the clock.
Right.
I worked at the Melrose. I was there 8.5 years. I worked at Love's Cafe 2.5 years. These are restaurants you don't know because they're gone. And but any of the old timers that know these restaurants, these were terrific shops. Then I worked 2.5 years on the Skid Road in a restaurant called the Garbo. This was mm-hmm. Scandinavian people had it, and it's where the Army Navy is now on Cordova. And the unemployed, the fishermen, loggers, and unemployed and seamen came in, and I'm telling you what a conniving setup. The woman, the husband was all right to work for. The wife was a bit of a chiseler. For instance, we were going to see the show Gone with the Wind. And so I had to come right as soon as I was through work because I wasn't going to eat. And Bill said, "You're late." I said, "I can't be. I just slipped right out of the shop and away we went." And next night when I was on the job, I happened to walk in the kitchen, turned around, came out, and here I caught the madam setting the clock back. So that explained it, you see. I wasn't aware. But this is what was happening, because he used to say quite often, "You're late." And
you couldn't understand why?
No, how could I be late? So anyway, the unemployed that came in, oh, I could write books about them. There was old people. I used to get quite a bang. I'd go to the fisherman's hall. There would be functions of some kind or another there, and somebody would come up and talk to me, and I wouldn't know who in the world it was, and he'd say, "You don't remember me." He used to serve me when I was in the Garbo, and, you know, they were much younger then, but now they're quite old.
So would you have a chance to kind of really talk to the guys mm-hmm. who came in?
Never turned anybody down that said he had no money. And I used to get a meal ticket, and I'd take it up to her and get her to stamp it. And she'd say, "You're feeding all the bums." And I said, "Yes, Mrs. Jackson, isn't it funny the bum gets hungry?" And I started to laugh. Do you know why? It took me back to when I was a youngster. We lived in Buffalo. We lived in Chicago, and then we moved to Buffalo. And the Buffalo Highway used to be just streaming with men, gangs of men. Now, I didn't know what that was all about. Didn't understand it at all. But I know now what it was. It was the unemployed of the First World War. There was tremendous unemployment then. And they used to walk up and down the highway. They'd have ukuleles, banjos, and mouth organs in those days. And, you know, every once in a while they'd have them and they'd be playing them as they walked up and down. And they used to come up to the house and they'd ask for food. Mother used to pan fry big batches of fried bread, which is delicious with fruit, and put out crates of apples. And I remember a lady coming up to my mother and said to her that she was feeding all the niggers. And that day, there were Negroes amongst them. And Mother said, "Yes, Mrs. Schmidt, isn't it funny?" She says, "But the nigger gets hungry too." And you know, I never forgot that. I remember one time there was a little Indian boy, and I was saying, "Nichi, nichi, nichi." Nichi is Indian in German. And I got nichi on my backside that I didn't sit down well for a week. My mother, she says, "I'll nichi you."
So your mother was progressive in her attitude?
Progressive and didn't know it. Mm. You know, she was progressive in a way that was, you never forgot. Mm-hmm. And like she, you know, just because you were home, you were expected to work just like anyone else, and there was no nonsense about it. As she used to say, "I'll break every bone in your body before I let you grow up and be a useless hulk on society." My mother never had a day's schooling in her life, and I have often marveled at the words she used. And that blueprint, I joined the Girl Guides. And I remember them talking about Girl Guide duties, you know, do a good turn every day. And I used to get quite a bang out of it. They never quite knew why I laughed every time I heard that word. Because Mother was very emphatic on help. She stood for no nonsense word, the help. You know, like a child, like on the bus. I see people today are so shameless about allowing children to occupy a seat and adults are standing. And I remember I was on a bus not too long ago, and there was a Negro woman with two children, and the little boy must have been 3, 4. He was sprawled right across the seat, and the bus was packed. And there was some old age people got on, and she was breastfeeding this one baby on a bus. And instead of calling the little fellow over and having him lean on her lap or whatever, she just left him there. And so an old man came along and just hoisted him up, and that was it. He sat down. But, you know, my mother would brook no such nonsense. She'd say, "Get up and give the seat to some, you know, whoever was standing waiting." And you know how a child is demure about it. My mother says, "Get up and give the seat. And if you sit any more," I hate to tell you what happened.
"You won't be able to sit anymore."
Oh, and then if you got in the doorway, Wobie tied you. That was it.
Right. In the restaurants, when you were working in the 30s, were there mostly other women who worked there, or were there men and women?
No, there was an occasional waiter that would work night shift, but in one restaurant, we had a waiter, and he had a habit of drinking and didn't show up. Now, you never walk off your station if it's not covered, you see. You have to have a station covered at all times. So I'd find myself working 16 hours. And by the time the morning rolled around, you put a zipper on your tongue, because when you're tired, you're apt to say something that you don't mean to say. And oh, I could write books.
Were these large places you worked
yes.
in?
Yes, places that worked around the clock. In fact, the Melrose had top room, the Gold Room. There was dances there every Saturday night, and dinners Sunday, and when the house was over full, then we'd open the gold room. And then there was a mezzanine floor, and then the main floor. And, oh, it was a busy house. We worked around the clock in it. And I could write books about the people. I like people. There was one man that used to come in there that was a miserable kook. And I've never quite understood it. He had a couple of our girls laid off because of him. And he was an old man, and he was rude, as rude could be. And I remember Tom demanded a letter of apology from me for this man. I said, never. He said, Mr. So-and-so is a friend of Mrs. Litsitis and myself. I says, Tom, that man's no friend of yours. During the war, he had some connection in the yard, or thought he did, he had a couple of girls laid off there because of his actions. So I took it up with a local, and I said to Tom, no. So I went up to Love's Cafe. Next day I was supposed to come to work, and I was to have a letter of apology. Needless to say, I didn't give the letter of apology. And I went up to work at Love's Cafe, because when I went to come to work, he still insisted on a letter of apology. So I just went up to Love's Cafe and I started work there. I was there 2.5 years, and he walked in one day, and believe it or not, I was fired the next day. Tom saw me, he says, lady, I never meant you to go. I said, you didn't mean me to go, but I says, you demanded something which I was not about to give. So I told Tom some of the antics of this clown. He'd come in, sit at the counter, open a newspaper, and clean his hair, clean the hairbrush, you know, the comb. I've just seen somebody cleaning a comb.
In a restaurant.
In a restaurant. Well, you know, that's just absolutely out. And I told Tom what he was doing, and naturally the people that took exception to seeing this, and I didn't blame them one bit. So men that owned the shop. Two worked in the kitchen, and Tom was the other one. So I told Mike what was going on. He was in the kitchen, and Mike had got his son a job. His name was Mike, too. And I thought, that's odd, because, you know, all able-bodied men that couldn't go overseas had to go in industry.
The war industry?
Yes. And even my own husband, who couldn't go to war because he only had the sight of one eye, had to go in the shipyard. And this Mike was just a boy, you know, a young fella, army age. And I thought, gee, that's funny. So anyways, I'm not about to do anything about it, but I would not give that letter of apology. So do you know what I did when I left Love's? I went down to Woodward's. I still retain my membership. I worked in union shops. Worked in non-union shops. I still retain my membership at all times. And so, lo and behold, if Mr. Love didn't come down to Woodward's, and I pretended I didn't see him, I thought, I don't know what's behind all this, but I'm not giving no letter of apology. You see how they operate it? So anyway, the setup of the city, that stage was really unbelievable. 4 o'clock in the morning, you'd have thought it was 12 o'clock noon. All the prostitutes in that neighborhood, you know, up where Robson Street,
mm-hmm.
and their cronies and whatnot, all came into Love's Cafe at 4
this
o'clock
the 40s,
in the morning.
During the 40s?
Yes. Yeah. And had their breakfast. You'd have thought it was 12 o'clock noon. I could write books about restaurants, but one of the things that happened at the Melrose was White Christmas, when it came out. I heard it for 16 hours straight. See, New Year's night, we worked double shifts. And it started, I could hear White Christmas as I walked in the door, and when I left it the next morning, 16 hours later, somebody put the record on again. It never stopped for 16 hours straight. I wrote what was his name? Crosby, a letter when he was in the hospital. And I told him, for somebody who had to suffer 16 hours of White Christmas, I says, you've got to get well. This is a command. And he sent me a beautiful letter. He said, with all the good wishes and the prayers and the command and the underlying command, he said he was going to get well, and he did at that time.
Were waitresses concerned about the kind of conditions in the restaurants in terms of health and
food? Union restaurants, but not that I know about the others. Because the conditions in some of the shops were deplorable.
Right.
And of course, the union at all times was the keynote for care.
Right.
See, I was a business agent in my union 1 year. And as I said, I might not have set the world on fire, but I'll tell you, when I handed the office open over to the local, everything was in order, so, but I laughed. This was during the war, and we worked tremendous hours then, and very hard. Restaurants these were shops that were open 24 hours around the clock, you see, so you didn't get any much chance for dragging your heels, because the places were packed. Love's was a place that the whole uptown and show people, and there was an opera group that was next door, so all these people came into Love's, and the food was out of this world. So you really worked around the clock.
Right. And it was almost all women then who worked in these places? Were there busboys?
No, there were waiters.
Yeah.
Waiters.
Were there differences in the wages between what the men would receive and the women would receive?
No. The pay is the same.
Right.
That is in union houses.
Okay. How about non-union places?
Union was, non-union were lower.
Right, for women.
But if you couldn't get them to join, what could you do? I remember an incident that took place. Every time I came down, I loved Chinatown in those days. It was so new to me, and the whole Skid Road was fascinating. It was tremendous activity down there, and there were street demonstrations, you know, where people were, I can't remember the name now of this particular person, but he had... there were talkers, you know, all sorts of activities on the Skid Row, and it was interesting. And I loved Chinatown in those days. And it was so fascinating to me. But every time I happened to pass a particular shop, Tommy Nelson, who was the secretary of the Labor Defense League, used to... we lived in the same building. And Tom would get off just at about the time that I was going to home.
Mm-hmm.
And if I passed by and he was there, well, we'd walk home to the same block. And we lived on the same floor. Tom, I lived in this alcove and Tom lived in the other. So, and every time we passed a particular restaurant that was down there, we saw what appeared. The girls always seemed to be having an issue with the manager over something. So when I got let out of a shop because I had been on the picket line, and so I was...
That was your first job?
Yes, I was free that moment. So I went and applied for a job at this place. It had a sign, girl wanted. And I went in, and the the lady, the man's wife, she was white, he was Oriental, and she hired me. She says, bring your knitting. Boy, as soon as she said that, I knew something was wrong, bring my knitting in a restaurant. So anyways, I came to work in the morning, and I didn't tell Bill, and I walked in, and the place was like a pigsty. I couldn't believe it. It was filthy. So there was very few customers in the daytime, but every time you waited on somebody, you had to make a slip and put it on this peg. So I washed the salt and the peppers and cleaned the counters and cleaned this, that, and the other and tidied up and left the place meticulous. I was embarrassed working down there. I felt like I was in a foreign country. You get that feeling. So the woman kept constantly saying, I recognize you from somewhere. I didn't know her. And there was very few people actually came in. So the trade was all at night. So when I came the day for payday, she said I had to come and see her husband to get the money. And but when she walked in, I saw her taking the slips off the peg and put them in her pocket, in her purse. And she said to me, here's the slips. And I said, I saw you put them in your purse. Now that was fatal mistake number one. I shouldn't have let on that I'd even seen her do it. So anyway, I came to pick my pay up that night, and but before I did, I phoned Bill to tell him what I had done. Boy, did he bawl me out working in Chinatown. White women aren't supposed to, you know, union members aren't supposed to be down there. So anyways, that was the turning point. This, I came in to get the pay, and Bill came up, and he spoke for me, and he said he was in to collect the money for Barbara Stewart. But at that time it was Gail, and the manager demurred. Do you know what he was doing? When those kids used to come in for their money, he was chiseling them out of their money.
And that's why there was so much conflict?
Yes, that's what it was all about.
So had you gone in there to find out what the conditions were like?
Yes.
So that you might organize?
Yes, but when I walked in, no, I wasn't worried about organizing. When I walked in this particular morning, I took a wrong turn and found that it was a house of prostitution. A drunk Chinese, under the influence of narcotics. You know, that type of nonsense. His arms going all over, and I'm looking, you know, this is all so new to me. And I could see the waitresses that I had only caught a glimpse of once in a while, and I wondered where in the world they went to. It was in the back part of the shop.
Let me just...
I didn't tell you what happened. He, Bill said that what the pay was, and this fellow near Puerto's. And he also had to pay for my apron. Well, that was the last straw. He almost pulled it in. He spent 7 years in jail. It was a house of prostitution at the back. Mm. Even the cook was under the influence of narcotics. And is sitting there in a chair with a great big long pipe.
Was it opium?
Yes. And he spent 7 years in jail, and the wife, she says, I thought I recognized you from somewhere. She says, the Trocadero Cafe. Well, that has nothing to do with me. If she recognized me, she was also prepared to send me down the river when she took the tickets off the peg and asked me where they were.
That's right.
I just happened to see her, and of course I was so naive, I told her. Where I should have just held it in, you know.
Were did white women, as a rule, not work in Chinese
white
restaurants?
White women, up to that time, worked in Chinatown, and after that it was forbidden by law.
Why was that?
Well, because they were in there, they were acting as prostitutes and all sorts of nonsense. a lot of skullduggery going on that wasn't very good, so they made women get out of there. And you never see white women work there.
So Chinese women could, though?
Well, there's Chinese women here and there, but as a general rule, you won't see any white women working down there. That's a good idea. I don't mean to imply that they're not on the up and up, but I don't believe white women should be working down there because they were being abused, really.
So was it 1936 that legislation came
No, it came in 36, about 37. It was in that period that this...
And did the union support that legislation?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, because women were being used. You know, that in essence, that's what it amounted to.
Did the women who worked in the restaurants get along with each other well, the waitresses?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Did people tip in those days?
Yes and no, depending on where you worked. I remember the first tip I ever got, I threw it at the person because I didn't know what it was, and I felt like I was being insulted. Don't ask me why, it sounds ridiculous. But tips wasn't the main objective. Work and wages was the objective. Mm-hmm. And I apologized to the person after because she looked so hurt, and I didn't mean to hurt her, and I told her that I didn't understand. See, I was so green about this. Come on, baby. I didn't understand. So she smiled after, but at the time, I was insulted.
Right.
Not knowing what it was. It's just like a man inadvertently gave me a $20 bill thinking he was giving me a dollar. So I sidled up to him and I says, I think you've made a mistake here, haven't you? And I showed him the bill and he near flipped. He had meant to give me a dollar and inadvertently gave me a 20. Oh, sure, I could have kept the 20, but that's not the idea.
Right.
It's hurtful because somebody meant well. Wait, tips wasn't the objective. Work and wages was the objective. To wait on a man at Melrose Cafe, and this is just some of the little peculiarities you'll run into. He came in from a hotel, an insurance business, and they had a lot of women work in the field. So then they'd meet at night and have a coffee and whatever, and talk over their work. And he'd throw a bill on the table, you know, big deal. They'd all walk out ahead of him, and then he'd pick the bill up and walk out with them. And I used to get the biggest bang out of that. It didn't hurt my feelings. But what amused me was it'd be about 15 women, you see, in relation to this work. And I used to like the flair, you know, he'd toss this money on the table and walk up and pick it up. Well, this is some of the people you meet.
Right. Okay, let's see. Did the women...